Warning, the following ZipRecruiter radio spot you are about to hear is going to be filled with F-words.
When you're hiring, we at ZipRecruiter know you can feel frustrated, forlorn even, like your efforts are futile, and you can spend a fortune trying to find fabulous people, only to get flooded with candidates who are just fine. Fortunately, ZipRecruiter figured out how to fix all that. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ziprecruiter.com/zip. With ZipRecruiter, you can forget your frustrations because we find the right people for your roles fast, which is our absolute favorite F word. In fact, 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day.
Fantastic.
So, whether you need to hire 4, 40, or 400 people, get ready to meet first-rate talent. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/zip to try ZipRecruiter for free. Don't forget, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. Finally, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip.
Welcome to Food Psych, a podcast dedicated to critiquing diet and wellness culture and answering your questions about intuitive eating and the anti-diet approach. I'm your host, Christy Harrison, and I'm a registered dietitian, certified intuitive eating counselor, journalist, and author of the books Anti-Diet, The Wellness Trap, and the new Emotional Eating, Chronic Dieting, Binge Eating, and Body Image Workbook, which are all available wherever you get your books or at ChristyHarrison.com/books. That's ChristyHarrison.com/books. And by the way, on this show, we avoid diet culture details like weight and calorie numbers, but we don't censor swear words or other adult language, so listener discretion is advised. Hey there. Welcome to this episode of Food Psych. I'm your host, Christy Harrison, and today I'm talking with Project Heal CEO Akira Gilbert about her relationship with food growing up, why she didn't realize she had an eating disorder, and how she finally began to heal, the importance of community in disordered eating recovery, what to do if community feels tricky to you, and more. I'm excited to share this conversation with you in just a moment, but first, a few announcements. The most exciting one is that I have a new book that just came out last month called The Emotional Eating, Chronic Dieting, Binge Eating, and Body Image Workbook. And if you're listening to this podcast, I think it could be worth checking out. I co-authored it with therapists Judith Matz and Amy Pershing, longtime leaders in the field of diet culture recovery, binge eating disorder, and trauma-informed care. And I'm really honored to work with them on this project. We joined forces to create a workbook for clinicians and general audiences alike that we hope will help you break free from the diet binge or restrict rebound cycle, recognize sneaky diets disguised as wellness plans, better understand the role food plays in your life and in managing emotions, unlearn harmful messages about what and when you're quote-unquote supposed to eat, dispel myths about weight, health, and fitness, and lots more. If any of that sounds interesting to you, you can learn more and buy the book at ChristyHarrison.com/workbook. That's ChristyHarrison.com/workbook. I also wanted to let you know that Intuitive Eating Fundamentals, the online course I've been running since 2016 that I created to help you make peace with food, is now open for enrollment. The course teaches you how to recognize and reject diet culture, take pleasure in food and stop fighting your desires, tune back into your body's signals of hunger and fullness, end the restrict rebound cycle, navigate emotional eating and learn new coping skills, and perhaps most importantly, avoid turning intuitive eating into another diet. Sign up for instant access to hundreds of hours of supportive content, including 13 modules on the principles of intuitive eating, deep dives into how to handle common things that come up when you're trying to make peace with food, and a live monthly Q&A to help answer all your questions. This cohort also includes a special members-only forum so that you can connect with others and support each other through the course, and alumni get access to future forums as well. Learn more and sign up at ChristyHarrison.com/course. That's ChristyHarrison.com/course. And now, without any further ado, here's my conversation with Akira Gilbert. So tell me about your relationship with food growing up.
I had a wonderful relationship with food up until a very distinct point in my memory that I didn't. I very clearly remember sitting at the dinner table and I was looking at a plate of food. I don't even recall what it was at this point, but I was looking at a plate of food that I personally just did not like. And all of a sudden, my family started engaging in a lot of conversation that made me realize that I should have shame around food, or made me think that I should be ashamed about food. And that was the first time that I became aware that, number one, food was something that some people had shame around, and two, that my body was something that I should be aware of, or that other people were aware of. And I was six. And at that point in time, I was going through a lot of emotional and physical changes, and I was trying to figure out how I could appropriately express my emotions in, quite honestly, an environment that didn't care to see it. I was a young Black girl, and my mother grew up in Mobile, Alabama, and so I love my family dearly, and they had a very specific way of parenting, more specifically in the sense of you do as you were told, and then that is the end of it. And so I was trying to find a way at that point in time to figure out how to not only express myself in a way that felt good, but also in a way that I could access. And I realized that the only way that that was going to happen was through food. And now this is after many years of reflection, of course. I don't think I had the verbiage at the time to put it in those words.
That resonates probably for a lot of people around the sort of lack of ability to express yourself and express emotions. And what did you do with that? Like, how did food become sort of tangled up in that?
It was at that point in time that I started binging food, and I didn't realize that I was doing that at the time. I do clearly remember being told to stop eating so much, stop eating so fast. And to me at the time, it wasn't eating a lot and it wasn't eating fast. And quite honestly, if I were to look at it more objectively, probably still wasn't. But that catalyst of not only constantly being told that, but also feeling the shame, feeling the guilt, feeling, quite honestly, emotions that I shouldn't have had to start to disentangle or disentwine at 6 or 7 years old was something that spurred the behavior on. And then the thought patterns followed. And then the shift in my values actually followed. And so coming back to, I realized that my body was not only something that I could potentially experience a lot of shame around, but also something that I theoretically had the ability to manipulate to feel better.
What were some of the messages you were getting about your body and about food? And what were the adults around you modeling when it came to food?
All I knew is that many people, predominantly the women in my family, had a ton of shame around their own bodies. They were all in larger bodies. And I was always very confused because these were people that I not only loved, and I loved their bodies and I loved how they looked, but these were people that I looked up to. And so to see them not only so critical of their bodies, but critical of the very specific aspects of themselves that I valued the most. I loved hugging them and feeling warm and secure and safe. And so for them to actively try to get rid of it was always a very confusing message to me, until I realized that that meant that I should try to get rid of it as well, to the degree, you know, that I thought was helpful or would make me feel not only more seen, but also more safe. Physically shrinking down into a smaller body was not about vanity. It was around, how can I find safety, right? These women that I care about in my life, the smaller they get, they don't necessarily seem any happier. They actually seem significantly more miserable. But it did correlate with the amount of safety that they experienced in the world. And again, these are all Black women. And when I was younger, I remember my mom having gastric bypass surgery or weight loss surgery. And I didn't understand what it was at the time. I just knew that she was going to have surgery. And I remember her body changing drastically. And I said, well, this is strange. I don't know how to feel about it. I suppose I shouldn't feel any specific way about it. But I do remember the way that other people's faces lit up when they saw her new body. And I remember the size of her meals after. And I think the thing that was most distressing to me, even till this day, was how many, not only people in her life, but specifically doctors and medical providers, pushed her to have that surgery and never asked any underlying questions around eating disorder behaviors, right? Even up until the day she passed away.
Wow. Yeah. And do you think she had some sort of underlying disordered eating going on leading up to that?
I do. And it's something that we spoke about in the year leading up to her passing. And she was very grateful that I had started Body Reborn and all of the work. And my mother was never a very emotional person. She did what she had to do in this world. And that meant being a caretaker for everyone and simultaneously being the extremely strong and resilient one in a way that was detrimental to her own health and well-being. And I think her eating disorder and those behaviors were just another outlet for that.
Yeah. How did your body get medicalized or not? You know, I'm curious if there was any sort of push from healthcare providers or if the medicalization you were seeing was mostly through what was happening with your mom and her body.
I think we actually experienced the process in a very different way, because when I was growing up, I was also keenly aware that even though I was internalizing messages around body size, I was in a small body. I still, to this day, have a degree of thin privilege. And so I say that because the way in which I interacted with the healthcare system was very different. And I think that a diagnosis took significantly longer because nobody thought to look for an eating disorder in a person of color. However, the fact that I was in a smaller body already made it so that instead of doctors pushing weight loss as the solution to eating disorder behaviors, they raised occasional flags. Whereas with my mom, she had those behaviors at least as long as I've been alive. And yet and still, weight loss was the prescribed solution.
I mean, I'm reminded of the quote from Deb Regard of, we prescribe in fat people what we diagnose as an eating disorder in thin people. And sounds very much like what was the case for you and your mom.
I agree.
How did you experience your disordered eating behaviors? Did you feel that something was off in your relationship with food, or did you feel like you were doing the right thing?
That's a wonderful question, because there was a point in time in which I think it was just an immediate reaction, where I internalized messages from the world around me. And I said, okay, this is what I should do if I want to experience more joy. This is what I should do if I want to be more accepted or find safety. However, there was a very clear point in which I had a value shift. And I think that this is resonant for a lot of folks with eating disorders, who there comes a point in time in which your thoughts and behaviors are spurred on by the fact that your values are rooted in something that no longer serves you, right? My values at the time were oriented around seeing thin as better. And I actually don't think thinness was the primary orientation. I think when I was younger, and again, didn't have as much understanding about why I was doing what I was doing, thinness might have been a visual goal for myself, but it was so about, how do I practice control, right? How do I experience resilience? Ultimately, I knew that I was a young woman, I was a young Black woman, and if nothing else, I prided myself on being a hard worker, being an overachiever, and being resilient. And no matter what obstacle was thrown my way, I prided myself in being able to overcome it. And that included thoughts that ultimately led to the destruction of my life in many ways. Thoughts and behaviors that led to that destruction, would I be able to overcome it?
Mm. And how did the eating disorder, disordered eating, destroy your life? What did it take from you?
So my mom ultimately passed away of heart failure. And I have no idea. I've had tests done since then. My heart is not nearly as strong as it should be. And it took years for it to get to a place in which it was functioning in a way that was acceptable for me, right? That allowed me to do the things that I want to do. I was pushing my body to limits that nobody's body should have to go through. And so it impacted my brain functioning. I thought it was normal at that point in time to stare at a page and have to read it 10 to 12 times over in order to comprehend what was being said. And there was a point in my journey in which I started actively practicing the affirmation of, thank you, body, for loving me, because I put you through all of this and I'm still alive. And I'm not only still alive, but I'm still able to carry out work that's important so that other people don't have to experience the same thing. And we tend to put a layer of vanity onto eating disorders of, if this person was not so vain, if this person was not so A, B, and C, if they just tried harder, then they could overcome it, as opposed to looking at the intersection of biological and environmental and social factors that actually lead to the development of an eating disorder in the first place, including trauma. Many people develop eating disorders after traumatic experiences, which was the case for me as well. And again, I spoke earlier about that one event that I remember being a shift. But what I didn't share was that immediately preceding that, I'd experienced a traumatic event that led me to seek out behaviors and things that I could do that would make me feel safer.
Mm-hmm. That makes so much sense. And I think it's so common for people with disordered eating that starts in childhood, right? That food is a coping mechanism that's available. Going to food is something that is accessible to a child in a way that other coping mechanisms might not be. Turning to food as a coping mechanism in that way, do you feel like that sort of created a cascade effect where then people in your life were responding to you using that coping mechanism without really seeing like what it was about?
Yeah, I think that mental illness is so often pushed aside. And now we've reached a place in which we're having conversations on social media and in public about the fact that we need mental health care supports and we need them embedded through all phases of life, not just childhood. Mm-hmm. And yet, and still, that was not the conversation at the time. People were responding to the fact that my body was changing, and my eating disorder specifically actually was, though it started off as binging and ended up morphing into anorexia. And so I was in this place in my life that people were responding to my changing body because it sent up red flags for them. And yet, and still, the response was either anger or disgust. And that only further fueled my understanding of, well, if they're responding with such strong emotions, then that means that I'm doing something right, that I'm doing things that nobody else is doing, right? That means that I'm resilient and that I'm living my life in the way that I should be proud of.
Yeah.
Let me be very clear about that. I should not have been.
It's interesting, in your Project Heal bio, you say you didn't believe your issues with food could be an eating disorder. And I very much identify with that. I had a similar experience of being, you know, quote unquote, healthy, and my disordered eating sort of morphed over the years too. But there was a lot of restrict binge cycling. But the overarching thing was like orthorexia and being, quote unquote, healthy and eating in this kind of societally sanctioned way. And so I got a lot of compliments and a lot of praise for the supposedly healthy eating I was doing. I definitely feel like it made it impossible to really see what I was doing as an eating disorder for a long time. I'm curious what your experience of that was like and sort of how you had a wall or a screen kind of preventing you from seeing it as an eating disorder.
Ultimately, when I thought of an eating disorder, it was this double-edged sword, and I'm trying to say it in a way that is not triggering for other viewers, but I was balancing at this precipice of both A, not believing that I was sick enough because I had not done a good enough job to control myself, right? To work hard and to achieve these things that other folks couldn't achieve to live in alignment with my values. And I still knew that I was sick because my body was failing me. And that was regardless of the size body that I was in. I had an eating disorder for longer than I would have liked to. And the constants in it were feeling incredibly sick, having headaches all of the time, and thinking that it was normal to have headaches all of the time. Feeling extremely lethargic and run down, and like waking up in bed and feeling like I had just had a full day. There were those symptoms that individually I said, well, everyone is tired. Everyone's tired, and I can't attribute this to my eating behaviors. And what makes me think that I am so sick that I should have to get help, that I even could get help if I asked?
Yeah. What did you think getting help looked like at the time?
At the time, I had no idea. And so I also want to add the caveat that I ultimately didn't get help for my eating disorder for a very, very long time. And when I tried to access care, I couldn't afford it. My insurance did not cover it. I was very thankful to have insurance. My insurance did not cover it. And at the time that I even first inquired about help, I was still young enough to be on my parents' insurance, again, which I'm very thankful to have had. And they did not believe that me having an eating disorder was applicable.
Wow.
They thought that I was disobedient. They thought that I was acting out or seeking attention, but not that I necessarily had an issue. And that's not something that I blame them for in the slightest, because given their life experiences and given how my mom had to rationalize her own eating behaviors as well, I completely understand why they would believe that, given their life experiences.
Yeah, there's just not a lot of sort of mainstream understanding of eating disorders. And there's definitely a stereotype around eating disorders being a way of getting attention or something like that, that a lot of people fall into.
I agree with you. Eating disorders are seen as a way to get attention as opposed to a response to barriers and challenging life experiences that honestly makes sense. It's not helpful, but it makes sense. It's a way that people often cope with things that they shouldn't have to cope with, that they shouldn't be equipped automatically to be able to push through. And so what can we do to equip people with those tools and resources earlier, more frequently, and regardless of their access to education, financial resources, and do so in a way that actually aligns with their lived experiences? So I mentioned my parents earlier, in that their upbringing and their perspective on the world made it so they didn't believe I had an eating disorder. And it isn't helpful for me to sit here and say, well, they should have done better. Well, they should have learned about eating disorders. Well, they should have used this different terminology. Because number one, for me personally, it's in the past and it's not helpful for me to harp on it. But more importantly, I think it has underscored a need, in that we're doing this in Project Heal as well, of making sure that we are utilizing the language that other folks use when talking about eating disorders. So a lot of folks that I know, and even myself, I didn't say I had an eating disorder. I had a problem with food. Mm-hmm. I was always working to, you know, change my body. I ate in secret often, but there were all of these framings that I made to myself and to others that didn't include the term eating disorder. If you were to ask me at the time, I would have absolutely said, no, I do not have an eating disorder. And so I think now that I'm in this position of helping others access resources, that we need to change our language as well to be more inclusive and supportive and reach folks where they're at.
Yeah, that's a really great point. I'm curious about your experience as a Black woman with an eating disorder, where, you know, in a society that does not see Black women or BIPOC people really at all as people who suffer with eating disorders, right? The stereotype, and I think it's changing somewhat in certain circles, but definitely I think the pervasive stereotype is still it's a, you know, thin white teenage girl or something. So I'm curious if that added layers of complexity, I'm sure it did, and how it added layers of complexity to your healing experience.
It did. And I mentioned earlier that my mom's family is from the South. And my mom grew up during the Civil Rights Movement in Alabama.
Wow.
And so when you think about what that experience was like and the values that she took away from it and what that meant for how I conceptualized the world and decided to move through the world, though I didn't grow up in the South, I grew up in New York. it was this experience of, I'm a Black woman, and therefore, number one, I know that there might be certain barriers against me. Two, I have experienced these numerous barriers. And three, I may move through the world differently than the stereotype of somebody with an eating disorder, but that doesn't mean that I don't have one. And so that both took a long time for me to internalize. And I didn't end up really figuring out how my identity as a Black woman fit in with my eating disorder until I built a community of folks who were other folks of color who had eating disorders. And again, they did not use that term, but they were activists. They were advocates. They were often peer supporters. And we built a community together where they helped me understand how my experience of race and gender discrimination in the world exacerbated my relationship with food and exacerbated all the challenges that I experienced preceding that. And so that's something that we focused on and continue to focus on in our Body Reborn Community Care Program, which is now under Project Heal, is how does that intersection of socioeconomics and housing status, food security, both whether you grew up being food insecure and or do you know where your next meal is coming from now, how all of those experiences can exacerbate or help us heal our relationship with food. And so understanding not just that I have disordered eating or eating disorder, but this is why it is happening and or continuing to happen. These are the triggers in my life that are either bringing up old traumas or continuing to negatively impact my relationship with food and my body. And so using that framing, understanding that when I go out into the world, I may, to give an example, I recently moved somewhere that is very different from where I was living before. And my first day here, a young boy screamed the N-word out of a car window. I have the appropriate resources now. And by resources, I mean community, meaning coping tools and whatnot to process and move through that. But at the time, there was a number of times that I experienced racial discrimination, gender violence that ended up making me only spiral further down because that was the one or at least the most prominent coping tool that I had.
Yeah. That makes so much sense why people develop eating disorders in situations like that and situations of trauma. Again, like you said, not that it's really effective in the long run, but it's available. It's something that people have access to, and it's a coping tool that becomes really ingrained over time.
And ultimately, we're creatures of habit. And so for us to not only develop these coping tools so that it keeps us in state of maintenance, but it actually feels really rewarding oftentimes, right? These behaviors. And so what I often try to explain to folks who haven't struggled with disordered eating, they misunderstand how much the brain, more specifically our reward centers and specific neurotransmitters, play a role in the continuation of eating disorders. And you and I may know this, but when you have it for a while, your brain also impacts your hunger hormones that allows your body to understand when it's full or when it's hungry. So it's significantly more than willpower, and it's even more than getting yourself the appropriate supports. You need to have the right combination of factors that allow you to experience healing, but it is possible. It's just going to look different for everyone.
How did you find or start to find healing? Was there one moment that sort of tipped it for you?
Ultimately, I got really, really sick, and I was so sick that I couldn't work for a significant period of time. I couldn't study, and I realized that my eating behaviors were the cause, but at the very least, they were making it significantly worse. And so because I was sick for that period of time, and I still had to live my life, I still had to go to work, couldn't focus, but I still had to go to work and do all these other things.
Were you in school at the time too, in college? Or
I was. And at the same time, though I was experiencing, you know, all these barriers, I ended up getting to a place where physically engaging in eating disorder behaviors was more challenging. The structure of my life, the way I had to work and study and all these things, made it so I was in an environment that physically removed the option of engaging in a lot of my behaviors for me. And so part of it was a choice. And I'm specifically reflecting on one experience, because you said, when did you recognize that you needed this and start experiencing healing? It happened a couple of times. This is just one point in time. And then, but I would say it happened three or so times before I felt like I was in a place of steady support.
So you sort of sought out some treatment or some help and cycled through a couple of times before you found the right support.
Correct. And that included a combination of community supports. I eventually was able to get a therapist, and then the therapist that was treating me and then the next therapist that was trying to treat me as well, quite honestly, weren't well equipped. They were well equipped to support somebody with an eating disorder. They weren't well equipped to support a Black woman with an eating disorder. They did not have the tools, and they acknowledged as much, and they were very apologetic, but they realized that the type of support that I needed wasn't what they could provide. And at that point, I had also run out of money. So I was like, okay, well, I just spent a lot of money to feel significantly worse.
It's always so frustrating when it takes so much to get to a place of seeking help in the first place. And there's so much hope that comes along with that. And then it's just like, nope, that's not the thing.
But what ultimately drove me to seek out support again was because, again, I made that community of people, and I could see people in that space that were on the other side of it, or rather had built an infrastructure of supports that made it look like their lives felt full and with purpose and happy, right? And I couldn't imagine happiness for myself at that time, but I said, at the very least, I want to stop experiencing pain. I think if you were to ask people who knew me at these points in time, or, you know, knew me tangentially, they would have said, oh no, Akira was doing really well. She was continually succeeding in this very narrow definition of what success looks like, right? I was, again, working and going to school. I got full merit scholarship, right? All of these things. And yet and still, I was in pain all of the time, physically and mentally, to the point that it was ruining my life.
Well, it sounds like, I think probably a lot of people with an eating disorder history can also identify with that, of like seeming to have it all together on the surface and struggling inside, but feeling like you don't have people necessarily who understand that. And that's what community is, right? That's what, you know, the need for community support within eating disorder recovery or eating disorder healing is, like finding people who can get that side of you and get what's going on under the surface and support you through it. How did you find that healing? Like, because you created Body Reborn, what drove you to create that in the first place?
After I had experienced different cycles through my healing journey, I decided that I was not only in a very good and supported place, but also in a place that I wanted to be able to support others. And so I became a peer mentor for other folks with eating disorders. And then surprisingly, obviously folks can't see my face, surprisingly, I'm saying that sarcastically, the people that were always matched with me were other folks of color, because I was one of the very, very few folks of color in the space. Mm-hmm. And so I was matched with folks of color, and the same story kept coming up over and over again of Akira. They keep referring me to clinicians that, number one, I can't afford. And number two, if I can afford them, or I save up enough money to be able to get some level of support, they don't know how to treat me. And they're trying, but they do not have a deep understanding of how my experience with race, how my experience with culture in this world has impacted my eating disorder, and that it has, at the very least, a significant impact on my eating disorder, if not is at the crux of my eating disorder. And so without that, we're not going to be able to move forward. Mm-hmm. And I heard this enough times, you know, over and over again, that around the start of the pandemic in 2020, 2021, I said, I'm sick of referring folks to resources that just aren't enough. So let's try to build a space of our own. And so we did.
I know Body Reborn is now under Project Heal, and so it might look a little different what the services are now, perhaps, or perhaps not. But can you tell us a little bit about like what the program entails and what is offered?
Yeah, so the program lasts 8 weeks, and it's a virtual intersectional community for folks who struggle with disordered eating and are folks of color. They face systemic barriers due to race. And so over the course of that 8 weeks, we have two sessions a week. One that's a general peer support session, which is for folks to show up as their full selves and speak about the really big milestones that have happened and the challenges that have negatively impacted them during those peer support sessions and gain community around it. And then we also have body liberation sessions, which is focused on education and live discussion around the intersection of systemic oppression and trauma and how that specifically impacted each person's relationship with food in their body. And so we do some deeper exploration to figure out, number one, what is that intersection? But number two, what does that mean for the triggers that we need to look out for? How we can build an infrastructure in our lives that, for example, so we have a portion where we identify our most common triggers. We build a care plan, and ultimately folks construct their own healing plan in order to figure out, okay, this is what I need to move forward. And so we do that in a carefully facilitated and supportive space.
Sounds really helpful. I'm curious, you know, something that came up for me, we talked in our teaser episode a little bit about community and the idea that Project Heal's slogan for Eating Disorders Awareness Week was let your community be your compass and, you know, the importance of community. And something that often comes up for me when thinking about community and talking about it with clients is that community can be tricky for some people, right? Group dynamics can be tough for some of us, myself included. And, you know, family dynamics and things like that, that maybe have engendered trauma in the past. And if you're in a family or a community or even like a subculture where disordered eating is normalized, I think it can be really hard to do something different in that environment and to find support in your community. So I'm curious if you have any thoughts on what it takes to build a truly supportive community and to have community care in your life when some of those barriers are in place.
Oh, that's a wonderful question of what it takes. Ultimately, it takes three things. Number one is enough of an overlap of shared identities in order to support one another. Number two is building trust. And number three is a common purpose that is positive. And so to that first point of having an overlap of shared experiences, have you ever had somebody come up to you and try their best to relate to you, and you're like, you do not share enough experiences with me that you're providing me with support and advice, and I appreciate it. I appreciate you going out of your way. And yet, and still, this is not helpful to me. It doesn't feel resonant. And so having enough of that overlap so that you're not necessarily consistently triggering one another, but you are able to have a bit of a mirror, if you will. And then next is the ability to build trust. It's very common saying hurt people hurt people. And while that is sometimes true, we often see that there is a tendency to hold on to a lack of trust, even when trying to build community. And so oftentimes folks will say, well, I want to build these deep relationships, but I'm not willing to be vulnerable and expose myself. And that is the risk of building community and building authentic relationships, is letting go of all of the resources that you've built up that protect you in terms of keeping yourself closed off and unavailable, and opening yourself up just enough to where, yes, you might risk getting hurt again, and you have to measure what that means against your healing, right? So how much are you able to open yourself up to the right people who truly want to support you? And then the third thing I'll say is around, you know, I mentioned that overlap of identities and building trust, but also finding folks who have a shared level of hope. And so what's a common thing in peer support spaces is sometimes we can get so stuck on all the things that are going wrong that we can't appropriately appreciate or drive toward what is going right, that we can't be grateful for the things that are going right. And so a combination of those three factors, as I mentioned, along with putting yourself in different spaces, one of the best things that I think I've ever done is intentionally ask people. I would like drop tidbits into conversations and start to open myself up to new people and just speak very lightly about the challenges that I was having and ask them if they knew anybody who had also gone through that. And so it sounds slightly formal in a networking way, but it truly was to build my network of people who might know other folks who were dealing with similar challenges, because there was a time in which I didn't have relationships that I would have considered extremely deep and extremely meaningful, but I knew that I needed to find them some way. And so online was one way. I have friends now, especially during COVID, that I'm just meeting them in person for the first time because we build those relationships online. And so different forums, honestly, like the comment sections of certain people on social media, pages that you consider to be more positive, uplifting, but also perhaps around a shared challenge. Oftentimes people in those comment sections can be your new source of community. If you say, I have no other ones, I would say be very intentional about the pages that you go to with that, because it can obviously go in the opposite direction. And then again, putting yourself out there just enough to where you feel like other people can help you build your community.
Yeah, I think that's really helpful. And I love the idea of like asking people in your existing network if they know someone who's dealing with some of the same issues, to find people in sort of an offline way. And then the online space too, I think there's so much good that can come out of social media in terms of connection and like feeling not alone and finding other people with shared interests or shared experiences and struggles. And, you know, it can go so awry too, as you alluded to, right? And that's something I've been thinking about a lot lately, is that many so-called communities online can actually be incredibly damaging to people's well-being, and the social media algorithms that are sort of governing everyone's behavior online tend to push people towards extreme content. And, you know, if someone comes in looking for basic nutrition information or mental health support, they can end up getting served content that promotes eating disorders or self-harm and, you know, extreme dieting and things like that. And, you know, there's also evidence that these algorithms amplify outrage and hate, and that that is what creates more engagement in the spaces rather than promoting positivity, right? So you alluded to this a little bit, but I'm curious, given all these perils of online spaces that many of us look to for connection in various ways, how do you think people can protect themselves and find real community and find those, you know, friendships that become offline friendships? And do it in a way that's not going to sort of reopen old wounds, maybe.
100%. And so I am personally a fan. If I am on a social media platform, I have multiple profiles. Because number one, as you said, the algorithm has a tendency of, it sees you're engaging with a certain type of content and it can take you in the complete opposite direction. And so I have profiles that I curate for different things. I specifically want to curate a space around positive mental health. I specifically want to curate a space around learning about crochet or somatics or what have you. And so I do that because it also offers the opportunity for me to say, you know what, I want to take a step back, right? Mm-hmm. If I was looking for community in the comment section of pages that specifically focus on healing your relationship with mental health, I might end up doing the opposite and looking for community in something that's completely unrelated to mental health, but is more oriented around an interest that I have, something that can give me a sense of purpose outside of my relationship with my mental health or relationship with food. And so it is something that, unfortunately, both A, has not been figured out, and B, that certain people and certain corporations are profiting off of. And that's something that we're working on at Project Heal, along with other organizations and social media companies, for example. It's never going to be 100% safe. Mm-hmm. But how can we move toward the collective good? And so that's something we're working in partnership with other organizations on.
That's incredible. And I'm curious to know a little bit more about your work with Project Heal and sort of how that came about and what you're doing now that you're integrating Body Reborn into Project Heal.
Body Reborn and Project Heal ultimately had very similar missions or fit very well together. And so Project Heal for the past 15 years and this year, we're going on 16 years to break down systemic barriers to the folks who are trying to find access to healing within the U.S. And they were trying to figure out ways to heal their eating disorder. And ultimately, our goal is to create a world where everyone with an eating disorder has those opportunities. And Body Reborn, again, was specifically focused on building a world for people who have faced systemic barriers due to race in order to find healing outside of the formal treatment system. And so we decided that it was for the overall good if we combined all of our resources together and move toward this collective vision, because ultimately, again, they fit very well together. It was just about how do we combine resources to move toward a greater vision. And so when we combine Body Reborn into Project Heal, it's also coming on the heels of a new program that we're getting ready to launch, which we're very excited about, because ultimately the eating disorder space is very small. There are not enough providers in the space that treat folks with eating disorders. There is not enough insurance support to treat folks with eating disorders. It's extremely hard to get reimbursements for eating disorder care. And so it's extremely hard to get a diagnosis. And I say all of that to say that we are about to launch our clinical care training program, which is specifically designed to train clinicians who do not specialize in eating disorders on how to start to treat folks who have disordered eating or eating disorders, and both A, identify them, B, treat them in a culturally competent way, and C, figure out when they need to refer to a specialist or that person to a higher level of care. Because ultimately, many clinicians are already treating folks who have some level of disordered eating, if not an eating disorder. But we want them to know how to do it well.
Yeah, that's fabulous. I think so many clinicians, like you said, are already seeing people with eating disorders or disordered eating and just don't have the tools or the education or the training on how to address it. And unfortunately, can sometimes exacerbate things because the prevailing quote unquote wisdom in our culture is that eating in a supposedly healthy way all of the time and trying to lose weight is a good thing, and eating disorder behaviors can be encouraged in the name of weight loss. So I think that's fabulous to have a training program that's going to help providers who want to do good and want to help support people to get the tools and the training they need to do that well. So thank you so much for everything you shared. I'm really grateful for this conversation. And where can people find you and learn more about your work?
So you can visit us at our website at www.theprojectheal.org. And you'll also be able to find our contact information on that site. And so if you submit a form, we are open to, again, not only if you know somebody who may benefit from our services, please share our information with them, but we also want to continue to spread awareness and education. And so if you are ever interested, or any of the listeners are ever interested in trainings, workshops, consultations on how to do this work better, we also offer those. And so please feel free to reach out to us via our website and we'll get back to you.
Thanks so much. We'll put links to that in the show notes too, so people can find it easily. Thank you, Akira. This was really lovely.
Thank you, Christy. I appreciate it.
So that's our show. Thanks again to our guests for being here. And thanks to you for listening. If you found this podcast helpful, I'd be so grateful if you take a moment to subscribe, rate, and review it on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. You can see all the places to subscribe at ChristyHarrison.com/subscribe. That's ChristyHarrison.com/subscribe. If you're looking for help healing your own relationship with food, grab my free audio guide, 7 Simple Strategies for Finding Peace and Freedom with Food. Just go to ChristyHarrison.com/strategies to get it. That's ChristyHarrison.com/strategies. To get full show notes and a transcript of this episode, go to ChristyHarrison.com/foodpsych. And to get the transcript, find the episode page and scroll down to the bottom to enter your email address. A big thanks to Softer Sounds for audio editing and production, and to administrative assistant Julianne Witasek for helping me out with all the moving parts that go into producing this show. Our album art was photographed by Abby Moore Photography, and the logo was designed by Melissa Alam. Our theme song was written and performed by Carolyn Pennypacker Riggs, and I'm your host and executive producer, Christy Harrison. Thanks again for listening, and until next time, stay psyched.
Warning, the following ZipRecruiter radio spot you are about to hear is going to be filled with F-words.
When you're hiring, we at ZipRecruiter know you can feel frustrated, forlorn even, like your efforts are futile, and you can spend a fortune trying to find fabulous people, only to get flooded with candidates who are just fine. Fortunately, ZipRecruiter figured out how to fix all that. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. With ZipRecruiter, you can forget your frustrations because we find the right people for your roles fast, which is our absolute favorite F word. In fact, 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day.
Fantastic.
So, whether you need to hire 4, 40, or 400 people, get ready to meet first-rate talent. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/zip to try ZipRecruiter for free. Don't forget, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. Finally, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip.
Shopify is a global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. And sell more with less effort thanks to the Shopify magic, your AI-powered all-star. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at Shopify.com/redcircle, all lowercase. Go to Shopify.com/redcircle now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/redcircle.